One of the most influential people in American music, Alan Lomax, would have turned 100 years old last week. Lomax wasn't a musician or a songwriter or even an impresario. He was a song collector. His field recordings helped launch the folk and blues revivals of the 1960s, and he influenced everybody in music, pretty much. It's possible that without Alan Lomax, we wouldn't have had rock and roll as we know it. But among scholars of music these days, Lomax's reputation has gotten a lot more complicated. There's been a backlash against some of his assumptions about American culture. Richard Paul explains.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
Let's start by giving Alan Lomax his due. The collection of recordings he assembled is nothing short of monumental. He started when he was 17, working with his father, John Lomax. Toward the end of his life, he imagined using computers to put the collection online before most of us knew what online was. Many of the years in between, he spent on the back roads of America.
This past summer, I spent traveling through the South with my father, collecting the secular songs of the Negroes.
This is a reading of an article Lomax wrote as a teenager.
Work songs, barrel house ditties, bad man ballads, corn songs.
This was 1932, when doing that was a radical act.
There certainly were not a lot of people who were interested in African-American culture.
Patricia Turner is a folklorist at UCLA. In the era of Amos and Andy, she says, Alan Lomax was someone
who thought that the everyday artistic expression of African-Americans ought to be recorded and ought to be preserved.
It started in the South, from what I'm thinking.
Start from slavery.
Yeah.
And as he recorded musicians playing, but also talking about their lives, like this recording of Big Bill Brunsey, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Memphis Slim.
At the same time, that's the way they paid. They didn't know anything about rent and those things in those days.
But you agree with me that blues helps a man out?
Yeah, for the feeling. You
think so? Lord, I can hear my name a-ringing all up and down.
Lomax considered song collecting to be something like a sacred mission. Here's how he described his quest in an interview near the end of his life.
I wasn't interested particularly in the old lazy ballads. I wanted the real raw stuff right out of the backwoods and off the creeks. And so the stronger it was, the better.
And he imagined himself in battle with a demonic enemy, the radio.
Not very long ago, there were hundreds of little separate communication worlds that existed everywhere. Literally hundreds of thousands of these little generators of the original. And suddenly, all those delicate structures are being smashed and scattered and suppressed by an overpowerful, over-rich, overreaching communication system.
Ain't got long, I ain't got long. Lord, I ain't got long at the mother's home. Pray for me, oh, mama.
On his first trip, he wrote about it for the Southwest Review, Alan Lomax set out with his father for a labor camp. They asked the white foreman there if he'd have his men sing them their work songs. Worker after worker turns them down, saying they only sing church songs. So the Lomaxes ask around and find the night spots where the guys go on weekends. But they're scared to go alone, so they bring some muscle.
On a Friday night, with a brace of city detectives to serve as our card of admittance and a guarantee that we were all right, we went into the dives and joints. Our hopes ran high. Until we noticed that shortly after our entrance into a beer parlor, a constrained silence would fall on the assembled men and women. We four, with the bartender...
Awkward. Here's the real problem. Lomax's blind spot. He was in search of pure black music, not realizing that, for the most part, it wasn't there. Carl Hagstrom Miller is author of a book called Segregating Sound, Inventing Folk and Pop Music in the Age of Jim Crow.
There's a difference between what folklorists were searching for
and what people were listening to and enjoying.
That's because despite the brutal laws of segregation, black and white cultures had been mixing, going back into centuries of slavery.
White slave owners and black slaves lived together, worked together, and worked the plantation together.
Remember that scene from 12 Years a Slave? It was blacks who learned and then played the waltzes, jigs, and reels at white people's parties. During the Great Awakening in the 1830s, blacks and whites went together to Camp Revival meetings. There, African religious and musical practices were dissolved into Christian hymns to create the songs we now call spirituals. Then, in the 1880s and 90s, vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley created a nationwide music industry. Dwandalyn Reese is the curator of music at the Smithsonian's new African American History and Culture Museum that's opening next to you.
By nature of the close proximity that two different cultures have by living next to each other, it's inevitable that the music and the cultural products that they're producing are intertwined and interrelated. People were singing each other's music, so to speak.
Ain't you coming along? Come on here, come on here. Alexander's ragtime band.
But when Lomax would show up in a black community,
he didn't ask, share the songs that you enjoy singing. He asked for them to find songs that fit into his idea of old-time folk songs.
If a man gave him a Tin Pan Alley number, or a church song his granddad learned at Fisk, Lomax would wave and just drive away. He never recorded at black colleges. It would take 14 years before he ever recorded in a black church.
You have no opportunity to hear what middle-class African-Americans are into, or what upper-class African-Americans are into, or urban African-Americans.
So where did he find his raw, real, authentic black music? In penitentiaries. Parchman Farm, Central State Farm, Angola.
The black communities were just too difficult to work in with any efficiency. And so my father had this great idea that probably all of the sinful people were in jail. And that's where we found them. That's where we found this incredible body of music.
Yonder come a Miss Rosie. How in the world do you know? Well, I know the body April. And the dress she wore, I'm a river on the...
As he wrote back in the 30s, in prison, if his sources weren't cooperative, they could be coerced. Easily.
Presently, the guard came out, pushing a Negro man in stripes along at the point of his gun. The poor fellow, evidently afraid he was going to be punished, was trembling and sweating in an extremity of fear. The guard shoved him up before our microphone.
He got a lot of unique music this way, like this song from John Gibson.
Step back, easy now. Bring him out in the short quarters. And walk over close by with him.
Lomax wasn't ashamed of his methods. On the contrary, he saved for posterity a song that no one had ever recorded, and possibly no white person had ever heard before.
The most important thing that anybody can do is to try to restore the balance. I call this cultural equity.
That's a very complicated issue.
Again, Dwan Reese from the Smithsonian.
It gets back to this issue of black music and white music and the expectations of who should be singing what. Also, the expectations and perceptions of what is African American, who is African American. And that gets embedded into stereotypes, degrading stereotypes. African Americans are criminals. They're illiterate. They're not serious. They're not smart. And so that authenticity is rooted in having that kind of vision of what an African American can or cannot be.
There is also a completely different way to look at this.
I don't think about authenticity at all when I'm playing music, man.
That's Dom Flemons, a longtime member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
I wished I had a nickel, I wished I had a dime, I wish I had me a pretty girl, you not call her mine.
They got really popular in the early 2000s, playing songs that leaned heavily on the Lomax music collection. Now, Dom is the same age as all these scholars, and like a number of them, he's African-American. He knows everything they know.
I'm not trying to, like, give Alan Lomax a pass or anything.
But still, he lands in a totally different place, because for Dom, the music is the thing that really matters. And without Alan Lomax, it would be gone.
A guy just sitting on a porch at home playing and enjoying the music is just him enjoying his music by himself. But if you want to hear it on a record, someone has to record that.
Was his music authentic? Is it the truest representation of what African Americans sang and listened to in the 1930s? His answer? Who cares?
In any of my musical work that I've put out there, I've tried to take what I've learned by experience, as well as take the scholarship that's been done about any of the stuff that I play, and I just try to find the best balance between that so that there's dignity. You know, from on my end, I tried to make sure that when we said it was traditional music, it sounded like traditional music, at least how, you know, the best I can do with the documentation that's there.
So there are at least a couple of ways to look at this story, but this much is undeniable. Right at the time the civil rights movement was trying to bring blacks and whites together in a common cause, Lomax drew a hard line between white and black music, one the record companies were happy to exploit, that kept us apart. As critical as Dwendolyn Reese is of Lomax, she does have some sympathy. She knows that we all have to make decisions and that, whether we know it or not, we all have biases.
I can't jump in his mind. I think he was trying to, in his way, collect what he thought was a true African-American cultural form of expression. And we all do as researchers. We all have our own biases and perceptions and expectations. And that's part of the challenge of doing that kind of work.
It's fair to say that in this story of black and white,
everything's always usually a grayer area than the history books write it down, you know?
For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
So what do you think? I'm betting some of you have pretty strong feelings about that story, and we'd like to hear them. Visit us at studio360.org and leave us a comment. While you're there, you can see Alan Lomax discuss his life and work in a 1991 interview with Charles Kuralt.